the host if she'd like to take a bath with me. This may have seemed funny to me at the time, but it wasn't for Nell, or any of the other people directly affected. I always had this madman inside of me trying to get out, and drink gave him permission. A diary entry of mine from the mid-70s, written while on holiday on a yacht in Greece, reads, "I'm sitting here drinking vodka and lemonade, having a party of my own. I'm very sad and pissed. I've been dreaming about what I would do to the first customs man who questions me about my guitar, or who, worse still, just touches it." It was my normal thing when I was angry to contest authority, so a customs official or a policeman or a concierge or anyone else with a uniform would get the sharp end of my tongue, and then it would be left up to someone like Roger or Alfie to clean up the mess or bail me out, make apologies, pay the bill, or do whatever it might take to redress the situation. Sometimes I'd invent mock dramas in order to pick a fight. I'd say, "You've insulted my wife," and use that as a reason to launch into an indignant shouting match against some innocent person I'd taken a dislike to. A notorious incident of this kind took place during the time we were living on Paradise Island, when I was invited to go to Tulsa, Oklahoma, to perform in a jam to celebrate the anniversary of Kane's Ballroom, a very famous dance hall that had been open since the days of vaudeville, and that was a popular venue for bands. Because of my connection with all the Tulsa musicians, I decided to go. I flew to Miami and from there to Tulsa, but by the time I got there, I was so drunk I was warlike. I had got in some kind of altercation on the plane, and they had called ahead to the Tulsa police, who were waiting for me when the plane landed, and I was arrested. When we got to the county jail, one of the cops involved used my middle name when charging me, saying, "Are you Eric Patrick Clapton?" I replied to this, "Nobody calls me Patrick. You don't have the right to call me that," and then I went into a tirade against him. As a result of this, I was thrown in the drunk tank. I kept trying to tell them who I was, but they refused to believe me, so I said, "Go and find a guitar, and I would prove who I was by playing." They did this, and then they let me out. The following morning, a large photograph of me staring out from behind the bars of the tank was on the front page of the local newspaper, the Tulsa Tribune. Flying off to jam with other artists was a good excuse to get away from Paradise Island. I played twice with the Stones in New York and L.A. as part of their tour of the Americas, and in August I flew to New York for a session with Dylan, who was working on the album that was to become Desire. I remember feeling very elated that I had been asked to play, but when I arrived, it turned out to be a very odd situation. Two or three bands were already waiting to go into the studio with him, including an English band called Kokomo. And every now and then a bunch of players would come out, and everyone would ask, "Well, what was it like?" It was not unlike being in a doctor's waiting room. I was one of five guitarists present, and when I went in, Dylan wasn't particularly communicative. It was one of those awkward times when I didn't really know what was expected of me. There was no question of a rehearsal. He played the song once or twice and then moved on to the next one. I'd say 24 musicians were in the studio that night, all playing these incredibly incongruous instruments like accordion and violin, and it sounded great, but I had no idea what was going on. I felt like Mr. Jones again, and remembered the first time we had met in London. I felt no closer to understanding him this time than I did then. I played along as best I could, but it was very hard to keep up, as he was racing from song to song. Then suddenly it was over, and he left. I couldn't wait to get out for some fresh air. Later he told me that he had recut all the songs again with just a drummer and a bass, and that those were the tracks he was going to use. I did eventually cut a track with Bob on our next studio album, No Reason to Cry, recorded during the winter of 1975 at the band's Shangri-La Studios in Malibu, California. This was a drunk and disorderly kind of album, and we didn't really know where we were going. We had no producer when we started other than our engineer Ralph Moss, and we just lost direction. Part of the problem was that the setting of the studios and the situation were so idyllic that I, for one, couldn't get myself together sufficiently to write any songs. After a couple of days, I was ready to leave, so I called in the band's own producer, Rob Fraboni, to help us. Richard Manuel then came up with a song called Beautiful Thing, which was the first number we recorded and got us off to a start. At the time, Bob Dylan was living in a tent in the garden of the studios, and every now and then he would appear and have a drink, and then disappear again just as quickly. I asked him if he would contribute something for the album, write, sing, play, anything. One day he came in and offered me a song called Sign Language, which he had played for me in New York. He told me he had written the whole song down at one sitting without even understanding what it was about. I said I didn't care what it was about, I just loved the words and the melody, and the chord sequence was great. Since Bob doesn't restrict himself to any one way of doing a song, we recorded it three different ways, with me duetting with him. It also gave me the opportunity to overdub Robbie Robertson doing his Wang Bar thing that I love so much. All in all, it's my favourite track on the album. One of the more bizarre guest appearances I took on during this period was in the south of Ireland in September, when I was approached by Kevin McClory, the Irish producer of the James Bond movie Thunderball. He was mounting a charity extravaganza at Strafan House, his home in Kildare, in the form of a celebrity circus, which he called Circasia, in which he wanted me to perform alongside stars like Sean Connery, John Huston, Burgess Meredith and Shirley MacLaine. Roger thought it would be a good idea, and as Burgess Meredith, star of Day of the Locust, was one of my heroes, I agreed to show up. It turned out to be an unforgettable event, and led to another interesting fork in the road. On the first night I met John Huston, and sat in a circle of people around him, all of us spellbound, listening to his reminiscences. The following day Burgess, Shirley and I were gathered up and given our skit to rehearse. I'd always had a crush on Shirley MacLaine, since seeing her in Irma La Douce wearing a tiny little teddy. What legs! I was keen to meet her, as she was known to be a very feisty lady. Our routine was loosely based on a piece of Chaplin-esque slapstick. Burgess and I were dressed as clowns, with wigs, big funny noses, and great big shoes, and she was playing the Chaplin tramp. The idea was that she would wander around the ring, and we would follow, each carrying a custard pie behind our back. We would sneak up behind her, with the intention of hitting her on each side of her face with the pies, but just as we were about to hit her, she would bend down to do up her shoelaces, and we would end up hitting each other in the face across her bent back. There were two shows, the first being a free performance for handicapped kids, where the routine went without a hitch, with me and Burgess smothering one another with whipped cream, which the audience thought was hilarious. The evening show was the earner, with tickets going for £5,000 a head. And of course, by this time, bearing in mind that we were in Ireland, the entire cast, with the exception of Shirley, had got blind drunk. Poor Mr. Connery lost control and went around the ring hanging underneath the horse he was supposed to be riding, which was five times more entertaining than what he was supposed to do, and Burgess and I took our cue from that. When Shirley bent down to do her laces, instead of hitting each other, we waited for her to straighten up again, and then hit her full in the face, one on each side. She was furious and chased us out of the ring, screaming blue murder. Roger told me that after that she would occasionally call the office to remark on whatever media trouble I had got myself into, still smouldering. Gorgeous woman. The place where we were put to stay was a charming little hotel in the village of Strafan called Barberstown Castle, part of which dates back to the 13th century. I immediately fell in love with it, possibly because the first night we were there I got blotto without parting with a penny. I literally stood at the bar and drank all night and never saw any money change hands. I thought to myself, this is heaven. And I rang Roger the next day and told him, you've got to come and see this, you won't believe it. A few weeks later we came out together and stayed the night and had the best time, getting pissed with the locals, all of whom, through our rose-tinted spectacles, seemed to be incredible characters and great singers. It had the same effect on Roger as it had on me, and we made the decision between the two of us to buy it. Over the next few years we got some good use out of it, and a lot of very funny and sometimes strange stuff would go on there, usually in the bar. The restaurant was the actual earning part of the business, and the bar was where the locals and myself would get completely legless every night. At the end of a good night it would look like a hurricane had swept through the room, with broken glass and furniture everywhere, bodies half hidden under carpets, and me unconscious behind the bar. In the morning the cleaning girls would come in, and within 10 minutes the place would look as good as new, ready for a lunchtime session. When, eventually, I became sober, it was decided that we should sell it. By then I hardly went there, and in fact it would have been a reasonably dangerous place to go. But I have extremely fond memories of my times there in the company of wonderful characters, like Breeder, our manager, and her erstwhile boyfriend, Joe Kilduff, my drinking buddy. They were great days. In the spring of 1976, after a year of living in the Bahamas and touring Australia, America, and Japan, I eventually returned to England, where, for a while, Nell and I enjoyed a period of real domestic bliss. Hurtwood was in a terrible state back then. It hadn't had a lick of paint or much care of any kind, because Alice and I had ignored and neglected it from the day that Monster started to restore it. It was borderline squalid. When we had a couple of dogs living there, Jeep, a Weimarana, my first dog since childhood, and Sunshine, a golden retriever, we would let them crap in the house because we were too stoned to clear it up. The curtains and upholstery were beginning to rot. Nell immediately threw herself into trying to make the house nice again, starting with putting an Argus stove in the kitchen. She was a very social lady and wanted to make the place ready to receive visitors. Like me, Nell enjoyed a drink, though it may not have been to the same extent, and so drinking became an accepted part of our life, and our activities branched off from that. The heroin culture, which I had been immersed in with Alice, had consisted mostly of watching TV or movies when we were not actually pursuing the drug itself. What now followed on from that was a much more pub-oriented lifestyle, starting with the Windmill, the pub at the top of the drive, and extending to Ripley to watch cricket matches and drink in a convivial manner with friends at the cricket club. Nell met Guy and Gordon, my old school friends, and once again they became part of my network. We were an outgoing couple, and we started to collect other couples. Local married couples became part of our social circle. Some were drinkers, others just liked to come around and have dinner. My life suddenly changed from being very introverted to becoming part of this golden duo, holding dinner parties and going out to premieres and things like that. It was much the same for Nell, who had been holed up for years in the gothic gloom of Friar Park with George. It was a fantastic time for me, getting to know all my Ripley friends again. We started something called the Ripley Spoons Orchestra. We'd all go to the cricket club, where Chris Stainton would play the piano, and there'd be 10 or 15 people all playing spoons and having a great sing-song. For a while, Nell and I really felt part of the community. During this period, Nell asked if I would meet a man who had begun dating her younger sister Paula. The idea was that, as acting head of the family, I was supposed to give this guy the once-over, to ascertain whether he was worthy or not. This suited my grandiose view of myself, and I went up to town to have lunch with him. His name was Nigel Carroll, and I liked him instantly. We had a lot of things in common, became good friends, and, of course, he got the thumbs up from me. He was pretty much in love with Paula, and I could tell that he was a capable and honest man, but unfortunately for him, she wasn't ready to settle. It was tragic, because Paula had a little boy, William, whom Nigel had become very attached to, and when the affair ended, he was broken-hearted. I asked him if he would like to come on the road with me to take his mind off things, and for the next several years, he was my personal assistant. I still saw George, who never lost the habit of coming around to play new songs he'd written. One Christmas Eve he came over, and when I answered the door, he squirted a water pistol in my mouth, and it was full of brandy. For some time we had this edgy relationship going on between us, and he'd often make sarcastic little remarks referring to Patty's leaving. He wouldn't hide it under the carpet. Sometimes we'd laugh, and at times it would be uncomfortable, but it was the only way we could go on. One night we were sitting in the great room at Hurtwood when he said, "Well, I suppose I'd better divorce her." To which I replied, "Well, if you divorce her, then that means I've got to marry her." It was like a scene from a Woody Allen film. Over the years, our relationship developed into a sort of cagey brotherliness, with him, of course, being the elder brother. There was no doubt that we loved one another, but when we actually got together, it could get quite competitive and tense, and I very rarely got the last word. Toward the end of 1976, an invitation came in to attend a big party celebrating the demise of the band. It came as a bit of a shock. I had no idea that they were disbanding, but I remember Robbie grousing about being on the road back at Shangri-La Studios. It was a tremendous honour to be asked to play. A lot of very respectable players were scheduled to perform, including Van Morrison and Muddy Waters, not to mention Bob himself. The new hotshot director of Taxi Driver, Martin Scorsese, would film it for posterity, and the band were going to play their final set with a host of guests getting up on stage. The show was at the Winterland, the big rock venue in San Francisco that had flourished throughout the 60s alongside the Fillmore. Patty and I flew over a couple of days before and started some hardcore partying. It was great to meet up with Robbie and Richard again. Needless to say, Richard and I got along famously. We were cut from the same cloth, and I loved all the other guys. They were like family to me. The gig was great, except at the beginning of Further Up the Road, my guitar strap came undone, and I only just caught my guitar before it fell to the floor. Van and Muddy stole the show. Although The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down stands as one of my favourite filmed live performances of all time. One day, an old beat-up bus rolled up the drive at Hurtwood and out stepped Ronnie Lane, whom I had known since I first met the small faces in a guitar shop in the West End. We had got to talking, and they invited me down to the studio where they were practicing. I remember watching them playing and thinking how great they were. The one I was attracted to most in terms of personality was Ronnie. He was sharp and well-dressed and very funny, as well as being very gifted musically. Then, when we were doing rehearsals at Ronnie Wood's for the Rainbow concert, he would drop by, and I remembered thinking that I'd like to spend more time with him one day. Ronnie was about to turn a corner in his life. He had left his first wife, Sue, and had taken up with a woman named Kate Lambert, who was into the world of travellers and carts and the gypsy lifestyle, so he was going down a road already familiar to me from hanging with the Ormsby Gore clan. I was immediately interested, particularly since I'd always known that we had a lot in common, and that sooner or later we'd probably get together. They parked their bus outside the house and stayed with us for a while. They told us that they had bought a 100-acre farm on the Welsh borders called Fishbull, and were living there with a motley group of musicians and friends. It caught me like a bug, and I couldn't wait to go up and visit them. My fascination with the life that Ronnie described to me went back to something I had been exposed to a little bit with Steve Winwood, when he was forming Traffic and I was forming Cream, and we had discussed the philosophy of what we wanted to do. Steve had said that for him it was all about unskilled labour, where you just played with your friends and fit the music around that. It was the opposite of virtuosity, and it rang a bell with me because I was trying so hard to escape the pseudo-virtuoso image I had helped create for myself. Ronnie was into the same kind of thing, but it was much more convoluted, because he was actually trying to combine his music with the running of a circus. It was called Ronnie Lane's Passing Show, and it featured circus acts like jugglers, fire-eaters, and dancing girls, as well as the band he had assembled, which he called Slim Chance, featuring, among others, Bruce Rowlands, Kevin Westlake, and Gallagher and Lyle. They would put up a big tent and then hang posters in the village, all done with a very casual approach. Whereas a real circus would have to get permission to go on the land a year in advance, they'd just turn up and put it up before anyone knew they were coming, and hope to get away with it. A certain number of the community would turn up, and if they were lucky, they'd make enough money to break even. This was a rarity, however, and the whole thing eventually fell to pieces. Nell and I started to go and visit Ronnie and Kate in Wales. We'd just show up and blend in, and although there wasn't a lot of room in the cottage, it didn't seem to matter. I loved hanging out with Ronnie because we were both drinkers, and as we spent more time together, Ronnie's musicality also began to rub off on me. Just like him, I was going through a very different period in my music. I'd been aware of J.J. Cale, and I was getting increasingly interested in country music and making music just for fun. I remember we once chartered a boat and sailed around the Med, and did a few shows off the boat in places like Ibiza and Barcelona. The band consisted of Ronnie and me, Charlie Hart on violin, Bruce Rowlands on drums, and Brian Belshaw on bass, and we'd sometimes set up on the key and play like buskers, while Nell and Kate would dress up in can-can outfits and dance. It was a complete fiasco, and we certainly didn't make any money, but it was a lot of fun. On another occasion, St. Valentine's Day, 1977, we played a secret gig at the Village Hall in Cranley, a village near Hurtwood, under the name of Eddie Earthquake and the Tremors. We did songs like Alberta and Goodnight Irene, and encouraged the audience of locals to dance and join in the singing. What it was about, for me, was drinking and escaping my responsibilities as a band leader, so I could just hang out and play for sheer enjoyment, and the music reflected this. Very homespun and mostly acoustic, it was in just this spirit that the song Wonderful Tonight was written. I wrote the words for this song one night at Hurtwood, while I was waiting for Nell to get dressed to go out to dinner. We had a busy social life at that time, and Nell was invariably late getting ready. I was downstairs, waiting, playing the guitar to kill time. Eventually I got fed up and went upstairs to the bedroom, where she was still deciding what to wear. I remember telling her, "Look, You look wonderful, okay? Please don't change again. We must go or we'll be late. It was the classic domestic situation. I was ready and she wasn't. I went back downstairs to my guitar and the words of the song just came out very quickly. They were written in about 10 minutes, and actually written in anger and frustration. I wasn't that enamoured with it as a song. It was just a ditty, as far as I was concerned, that I could just as easily have thrown away. The first time I played it was around the campfire up at Ronnie's, when I was playing it for Nell, and playing it for Ronnie too, and he liked it. I remember thinking, I suppose I better keep this. Wonderful Tonight ended up on the album Slow Hand, the first record I cut with Glyn Johns as producer, in the spring of 1977. Over the years the name Slow Hand had stuck, and was especially popular with the American band members, maybe because it had a Western ring to it. Glyn had a terrific track record. Best known in England for his work with the Stones, he had also worked with the Eagles and really understood American musicians. He was a disciplinarian who didn't like people mucking about or wasting time. When we were in the studio, he expected us to work, and he'd get frustrated if there was any goofing off. Even though we were all getting stoned and drunk, we responded to that quite well. He brought out the best in us, and as a result that album has great playing and a great atmosphere. Nell and Dave Stewart and I designed the artwork for the album, which is credited to L and Nell, Inc. Among the various snapshots pasted across the inside cover, including one of me and Nell kissing, is a photograph of a smashed-up Ferrari, a reminder of an incident that very nearly led to my premature demise. I collect Ferraris, an obsession that goes back to my friendship with George. One day in the late 1960s, he arrived at my house in a dark blue Ferrari 365 GTC. I'd never seen one in the flesh before, and my heart melted. At that point it was like seeing the most beautiful woman on earth, and I decided there and then that even though I couldn't drive a car with a manual gearbox, I was going to have one too. He gave me the number of the dealer, and I called them and got driven over to the showroom in Egham, where I ordered a new 365 GTC, like George's, for the princely sum of $4,000. They delivered it to Hurtwood and asked me if I'd like to test drive it, to which I replied coolly, "No, I'm too busy, just leave it, thank you very much." So they left it in front of the house. I had no license, and had only driven an automatic, so I set about teaching myself to drive using a clutch in that Ferrari on the drive at Hurtwood. I loved that car, and when I was in the Dominoes I toured in it with Carl and me driving all over England. Then I bought a Daytona and a 275 GTB, followed by a 250 GT Lusso. In those days I had garage space for only two cars, so I would buy and sell and buy and sell. The crash in the picture took place soon after we got back from touring Australia. I had been drinking on the flight all the way home, and it was still in my system. As soon as I was home, I got into the Ferrari and had probably hit about 90 miles an hour in a very short time, when a laundry van appeared, and I drove straight into it. I turned the van right over. My skid marks were in a straight line, and they found me with my head hanging through a side window. They had to cut me out of the car, and I was badly concussed and had a pierced eardrum. I didn't know where I was for 2 weeks afterward. It was a very close shave. My drinking was getting worse all the time, and I was starting to get into trouble at the windmill, usually just verbal, but sometimes becoming physical. Then I would get into the car and crash it into the fence between the pub and the house, a distance of about 300 yards. Drink was also affecting my performance. During one London concert in April 1977, I just walked off the stage after about 45 minutes. It was at the end of a British tour, and we'd added on one last show at the Rainbow, and my system just couldn't take it. Halfway through the set, I started to feel pretty strange, and it got worse and worse, and I thought, well, if I don't walk off now, I'm going to fall over. So I stumbled off. Roger took me outside for some fresh air, telling me, "You don't have to go back on, boy. You don't have to go back on. Don't worry about it. If you're not feeling all right, we'll call it a day." I sat in the dressing room for a while. Then Pete Townsend, who was guesting with the band, came in and said quite angrily, "Is this what you call show business?" The result was that I made it back on after Pete and got through the rest of the performance by literally miming his playing and singing. Looking back, I can't believe the ways I endangered my life. Returning from Japan in the autumn of 1977, we stopped off to do a couple of shows in Honolulu. On one of the nights I happened to know that my drummer, Jamie Oldacre, had pulled a girl and taken her back to his room, and I decided that I would spoil it and also give him a fright. I had a ceremonial samurai sword with me, a tourist souvenir rather than a real one, so I got myself dressed up in a pair of pyjama bottoms, into which I somehow tucked the sword, and, naked apart from that, climbed out onto the balcony of my hotel room. Then, edging myself round the ledge that protruded from the wall of the hotel and connected the balconies, I climbed from balcony to balcony to the room where I knew Jamie was sleeping. When I finally climbed through his window, he was furious. We were 30 floors up, and I was drunk, and the poor girl was freaked out of her mind. I was a bit disappointed and couldn't see what all the fuss was about. It was supposed to be a brilliant joke. Worse was to come. We were startled by a knock at the door, and when Jamie opened it, two guys with guns were outside pointing them at our door from a crouch position. Someone had spotted me out on the ledge and thought I was some kind of an assassin and called the police. When they realized it was just a drunken idiot making a fool of himself, they begrudgingly let me go. But it took a lot of sweet talk from Roger, who was getting quite good at this. Unfortunately, such behavior did little for my reputation. And when, in November 1978, Roger had to cancel a show in Frankfurt for technical reasons, the headlines of one of the big national papers screamed, "Eric Clapton, too drunk to play." The tour in question was a little jaunt dreamed up by Roger, both to promote our new album and to be the subject of a candid documentary film about life on the road, to be called Eric Clapton's Rolling Hotel. The idea was that the band would tour Europe by rail, aboard not an ordinary train, but three coaches that had once been part of Hermann Göring's own private train, which Roger had tracked down somewhere in Europe. They consisted of a drawing-room coach, a restaurant coach, and a sleeping car, and they would be hooked up to trains that happened to be going in the direction we wanted. Roger thought this would be great fun for one and all. I thought so too, and went along with it. After all, I loved trains, and would be able to drink and lord it up without offending members of the public. Maybe that's why Roger dreamed it up in the first place, to keep me out of harm's way. The film, by BBC producer Rex Pike, famous for his documentary Ackenfield, was luckily never released. It showed me in an extremely unflattering light, as I was intoxicated and deranged in most of the footage. It includes a sequence shot in Paris during a visit to one of the shows by Stigwood, in which, fueled by drink, I grabbed the camera, aimed it at him, and started to aggressively question him on the subject of an old chestnut of mine, namely my suspicion that he had creamed off most of the profits from cream to finance his other acts like the Bee Gees. Robert remained quite unfazed by this and quietly replied in his phony, posh English accent, "This is not the right time to speak about this. We should talk about this another time," while I shouted manically, "This is my film and I want it in." I remember we had a great promoter on the tour, a Danish guy named Eric Thompson, who was a friend of Roger's and in Stiggy's league when it came to pulling pranks. He would bait me, or Roger, hurling pathetic insults at us in a very strong Danish accent, until we would finally have to do something about it. Usually it would be something fairly mild, like throwing his shoe out the window of a travelling coach, or running over his precious aluminium briefcase with a truck. But on one occasion we went too far, cutting off all his hair, painting his head with blue ink, cutting the legs off his trousers, and throwing him off the train in Hamburg in the middle of the night with no money, knowing full well that he was supposed to have a business meeting with Sammy Davis Jr. the following morning. Sadly, he is no longer with us. He passed away quite recently, and I miss him. He was a great character, and an incredible sport, and we will not see his like again. The album we were promoting on this tour was the follow-up to Slow Hand, which we had named Backless, a title suggested after we played a gig with Dylan at Black Bush Airport. It referred to the fact that I thought he had eyes in the back of his head and knew exactly what was going on around him all the time. It had been a difficult album to cut, with drugs and alcohol taking center stage, which Glynn found hard to cope with, and there was bad blood building up everywhere. The only song on the album that I really rated was Golden Ring, written about the situation between me, Nell, and George. It referred in part to her response to the news that George was getting married again. She took it quite hard, and I, in my arrogance, found that hard to understand. So I wrote this song about the peculiarity of our triangle, which finishes with the words, "If I gave to you a golden ring, would I make you happy? would I make you sing? The fact is that at this time, for whatever reason, Nell and I were not particularly happy. My diary for September the 6th, 1978, reads, "Sex life is pretty barren at the moment. We don't seem to be getting on too well. There's nothing in particular to blame, unless it's the stars. We just seem to be heading in different directions." Nor did my often chauvinistic behaviour improve the situation. For example, I noted on October the 16th, "In the evening, Nell was giving advice to Simon's ex-girlfriend in the kitchen for 2 hours, so my dinner was taken out of the oven and popped back in again. By the time I got it, it was burnt and dried up, so I shouted at her, good, loud and long, but she didn't seem very repentant, and I got a sore throat." I was also picking up girls for sex as soon as I got on the road, aided and abetted by Roger. "Roger started to wind me up," I wrote in Madrid on November 5th, "about some incredible-looking bird who, he says, has turned up at the gig." Later that day I continued, "I've got £100 bet with Roger that he can't pull a nice, clean, normal bird for me. He had better, because there was nothing under 50 years old in sight." Then when, on November 19th, Nell finally came to visit me in Brussels for a couple of days, I noted, "I went to sleep with all my clothes on. I just can't get it on with Nell now that she's here. It's so sad for us. But the road is the road, and home is home, and never the twix should mix." Coming to visit me on tour was a rarity for Nell, as Roger and I had long ago come to a strict agreement that there should be no women on tour. This was a rule that applied to everybody, from the band leader downward. And it was completely transparent. Everyone knew what it was really about. Nell, of course, was not too happy about this, which she considered very chauvinistic, and it became a frequent source of friction between us. She often told me she felt isolated and lonely. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that whenever I was on the road I was being constantly unfaithful. I'd tell her all about it on the basis that if I was honest with her and confessed to what I had been doing, then it would somehow make it okay. She would rail at me occasionally, but I think her main concern was to try somehow to preserve the status quo, in the hope that things would change. What was her alternative? To leave and start again with someone else? Everything finally came to a head when I found myself falling in love with one of these girls, or at least thinking I was falling in love. "No more tequila for me, boy," I wrote in the diary on November 28th. "Woke up with all the clobber on. I'm in love again, and it hurts." The woman in question was a young girl named Jenny McLean, and the unforgivable thing I did was to allow Nell, sometime early in the following year, to catch us together at Hurtwood. She left the house in a flood of tears, having packed her bags, and phoned her sister Jenny to come and collect her. A couple of days later she flew to L.A., where she went to stay with Rob Fraboni and his wife Mile. At that point I did not give up Jenny, but went on tour to Ireland, where Jen came out to visit me. On March 17th, Nell's birthday, I recorded in my diary that "the gig was great, and sweet Jen flew in to make the day perfect. We talked and talked about our respective wounds." The entry finishes with the words, "I'm a bad man, and I think the world would better roll on without me for a while anyway. All in love is fair." Ironically, it was Roger who saved the day for me and Nell. When I got home from Ireland, he told me over a game of pool at his house that I should be discreet in my meetings with Jenny, or we'd get snapped by a photographer and it would be all over the papers. I said that was rubbish, and ended up drunkenly betting him the ridiculous sum of £10,000 that he couldn't get my picture in the papers. The following morning, to my utter amazement and horror, Nigel Dempster's column in the Daily Mail announced, "Rock star Eric Clapton will marry Patty Boyd." Roger had pulled a fast one. I jumped into my Ferrari and drove to his office, where I screamed at him that he had no right to make such huge decisions about my personal life. When I'd calmed down a bit, he asked me if it wasn't time to decide whether or not I wanted to stay with Nell or break with her forever. "How do I get her back?" I replied. He said that she wouldn't have seen the story yet, and that I should call her and ask her to marry me. When I phoned Rob's house in L.A., Nell was out, down at the beach in Malibu. I told him to give her a simple message. "Please marry me." When she called back later, I swore to her that I had given up Jenny and proposed. She burst into tears and accepted. The ceremony finally took place on March the 27th, 1979, at the Apostolic Assembly of Faith in Christ Church in Tucson, Arizona. the town where the following day we were due to play the first date of a major American tour. We had a Mexican preacher, the Reverend Daniel Sanchez, and a black organist, who looked a bit like Billy Preston. The band and roadies all wore rented tuxedos, and my outfit consisted of a white tux with black edging around the jacket, a $200 white cowboy hat, and cowboy boots, while Nell wore a cream satin dress by Ozzie Clark. Roger gave her away, and she was attended by two maids of honour, Mile Fraboni and Chris O'Dell. Rob Fraboni acted as my best man. The preacher read from the first letter of St. Paul to the Corinthians, in which he praises love. The service was short and sweet, funky and soulful, which was just what we wanted. When the ceremony was over, we all returned to our hotel, where they put aside a room for the reception. The table was dominated by the usual wedding cake, about 5 tiers tall, and Roger had hired a photographer to take pictures. Typically, after the cutting of the cake, when he came over to photograph me and Nell together, I threw a piece of cake at him, covering his beautiful Nikon camera. He obviously felt completely out of his depth because he didn't dare make a fuss, and then a food fight started. Soon everyone was covered in cake. We didn't eat the cake, we just wore it. The following night we played our first show of a 3-month tour at the community center in Tucson, and when we played Wonderful Tonight, I brought Nell up on stage so that I could sing it to her. The reception from the crowd was ecstatic. The End of the Road. However much I might have thought I loved Patty at the time, the truth is that the only thing that I couldn't live without was alcohol. This really made my need or ability to commit to anything, even marriage, pretty inconsequential, and anyway it was only a matter of time before the no women on the road rule was invoked, and then I'd be off and running again. Patty came with me to Albuquerque, New Mexico, then to El Paso, Texas, and from there to all the gigs till we got to San Antonio. At each show I would bring her up on stage and sing Wonderful Tonight to her. But after the San Antonio gig, I told her that she must go back to England. It was men-only time again. I had had enough of domestic bliss. She was not at all happy about this, and of course as soon as she was gone it was back to business as usual. One of the first things Patty did when she got back to England was to start organizing a party for all our English friends to celebrate our wedding. It was set for Saturday, May 19th, when there was a break in my tour schedule, and was to take place in the garden at Hurtwood, where a huge tent would be erected. Guests were instructed to turn up about 3 p.m., and told that they didn't have to bring presents if they didn't want to. "If you are free," we had printed on the invites, "try and make it. It's bound to be a laugh." There was no real form to the party. People were just expected to arrive whenever they wanted, wearing whatever they liked, and have a good time. The first person I remember showing up was Lonnie Donegan, who came far too early at about 10 a.m., followed closely by Georgie Fame. I didn't have a clue what to do with them, and we ended up going upstairs to a small bedroom where Georgie began rolling joints. I stayed up there for most of the day, getting stoned and becoming more and more paranoid as people were arriving. I really had no idea how to be a host, and couldn't cope. So instead of being around to greet everybody and offer them drinks, I hid. Eventually, sometime during the evening, I went downstairs to the tent to find this huge party going on, with hundreds of people, from all my famous musician friends to the grocer and the butcher and all the Ripleyites, milling about, chattering, eating and drinking, and making out in the bushes. It actually looked like the kind of party I would like to go to. A stage had been set up in the tent, the idea being that the band would consist of anyone who felt like getting up and playing. A succession of great musicians joined in the jam session that took place later in the evening, including Georgie and Lonnie, Jeff Beck, Bill Wyman, Mick Jagger, Jack Bruce, and Denny Lane. I remember Denny's wife Jojo getting up to sing, and then we couldn't get her off, so whoever was at the mixing board had to keep switching off whichever mic she was using, and she would just move to another one. George, Paul, and Ringo also played, only missing John, who later phoned me to say he would have been there too if he had known about it. How that came about, I'll never know. Suffice to say, I had little to do with the invitations. But a great opportunity was lost for the Beatles to reform for one last performance. Patty had also made the mistake of giving our bedroom to Mick Jagger, who was in the early stages of his romance with Jerry Hall, so we couldn't go to bed, which I thought was completely ridiculous. so I decided to target a friend of Patty's named Belinda, who I was convinced was going to make herself available to me at any moment. I hid in a cupboard, with the intention of pouncing on her at some point, but instead I fell asleep, and woke up later that day to find a mess that was to take 2 weeks to clean up. Among the guests at this wonderful party was my mother Pat, who had become part of my life again after the death of my half-brother Brian. Her loss had put a lot of strain on her marriage to Mac, which had gradually started to erode. To get away from it all, she came back to Ripley, where, as she slowly rekindled all her childhood friendships, she eventually decided to stay. At first, she lived with Rose until I bought her a little house on the village high street, right next to a restaurant called the Toby Jug. Initially, I was rather frightened of Pat. She had a quick temper, and our relationship was inclined to be tempestuous. I'd seen so little of her in my life that most of what I knew about her had come from outside sources, and I was never really sure just what the truth was. At that stage in my life, however, I made the decision that this didn't really matter, and that instead of constantly stirring things up, I should just learn to get on with her and have fun. I liked the surface that I saw, because she was very like me, particularly in the things that made us laugh. So I decided that we should use Ripley and its social scene as a way of getting reacquainted. She enjoyed a drink, so we went out to pubs to drink and socialize and use the company of others to get to know one another again. It may not have been a very direct approach to the relationship, because I didn't spend much time alone with her, but it worked very well. And the fact is that, as an alcoholic, I wasn't well enough to know how to deal with deeper things. Soon after her return, Pat struck up a friendship with her childhood friend Sid Perrin, a charismatic man, handsome, not in the Errol Flynn mould, but rather more like W.C. Fields. Sid was extremely popular and well-loved, and a kind of hero in Ripley, through his achievements as a good cricketer and footballer, but most of all as a singer. He had a tenor voice in the style of Mario Lanza that was a bit melodramatic, almost a caricature of a voice, but he could actually carry a song very well with a great deal of emotion. He was very gregarious and loved the spotlight, though only on a small scale, because given the opportunity to step onto a stage, which I gave him from time to time, for instance when we played local gigs like the Guildford Civic Hall, he would blanch with fear. In his own environment, however, in the village pub or the cricket club, he shone, and Pat adored him. This made me happy too, as I had always hero-worshipped him, and I hung out with them a lot. My developing relationship with my mum was also greatly helped by the fact that she and Patty got on really well, and had become firm friends. They also shared an irreverent sense of humour, as I did, which could be sarcastic and cruel at times, though without any real malice. This form of humour was a Ripley trait, and a number of my boyhood friends like Guy, Gordon and Stuart were all fast-witted in this area. Their repartee was fast and cutting, with a lot of teasing involved, and if you could handle yourself in those situations, then you were in. Since I had begun to develop a bit of a home life with Patty and the Ripleyites, my English humour was in full flow, and unfortunately it was the one area in which I did not gel with my band. They all came from Oklahoma, and their humour was very different. Though it too was very dry, it was parochial and rather cowboy-oriented, having to do with events and things taking place in their neck of the woods, whereas ours was more music hall stuff and silly gags. There was little cross-fertilization in the days before Monty Python took off in America. All this struck home at the beginning of 1979, when, owing to prior commitments, George Terry left the band, and I hired an English guitarist, Albert Lee. Albert was a great guitar player I had known since the John Mayall days, when he played in Chris Farlow's band. My take on him then had been that he was a brilliant player, but that he came from a more jazz or rockabilly direction, so I could admire him without thinking of him as a rival. He went on to play with Head, Hands and Feet, and over the years we became good friends, and would, if one of us had to drop out of a gig for some reason, occasionally stand in for one another. Then he moved to America, where he was in great demand as a session musician. When George left, Roger Forrester suggested that I should bring an English guitarist into the band instead of always playing with Americans, and recommended Albert as a possible replacement. I thought this was a great idea, though knowing Roger, he'd probably had it all worked out for ages. When I got together with Albert, we immediately bonded in our humour, sharing a love of Python and Spike Milligan. To a certain extent, music became incidental, because the kind we made, blues and R&B, came from such a strong source that it would never be threatened by the difference in our influences. We formed ourselves into a mock duo called the Duck Brothers, and spent our spare time on the road entertaining ourselves by playing tunes on a couple of rare Acme Bakelite duck whistles we had found, and which had a great tone. Unfortunately, this didn't go down at all well with the Americans, who just didn't get it. And things were not helped by the fact that Albert and I were boozers, while Carl, Jamie and Dick were doing drugs of a more isolationist variety. It was the beginning of a rift that began to form between me and Albert and the rest of the guys. By the spring and early summer of 1979, when we were touring the States promoting our latest album, Backless, this division had grown into marked bad feeling. A lot of paranoia was in the air, reminiscent of the days of the breakup of the Dominoes, and we were not spending enough time with one another in a clear-headed way for us to overcome these feelings. It just became accepted that I was going down one road with Albert, having the kind of fun we were having, while the others were doing their own thing. It got to the point where we were even keeping different timetables. When we were on stage it was all okay, but everything else was suffering. Unbeknownst to me, Carl Radel had become a serious heroin addict, and my condition was going downhill too. I was drinking at least 2 bottles a day of anything I could get my hands on. By the time the tour ended in June, things had got to such a bad state that I knew there had to be a change. So with great trepidation, I instructed Roger to get rid of the band. He fired them all by telegram while I looked the other way. Over the next 2 years, my drinking brought me to rock bottom. It infiltrated everything I did. Even my new band was born in a pub. Gary Brooker was an old friend from the Yardbirds days, when he had been keyboard player for the Paramounts. We had toured together and got on very well, and over the years I would bump into him occasionally, when he was with Procol Harum, and we developed a friendship and mutual respect. Then in the mid-70s he started playing in a pub not far from Hurtwood, the Parrot Inn in Forest Green, 2 or 3 times a week, and when I was at home I would sometimes go over and jam. This had become more frequent since Patty and I had married, and Joe Cocker's brilliant keyboard player Chris Stainton had also become involved. Gradually, we began to put together a new outfit, consisting of me, Gary, Chris, Albert, Dave Markey on bass guitar, and Henry Spinetti on drums. After trying ourselves out on a local audience in Cranley Village Hall, we went out on the road, around Europe and the Far East, and the concerts in Budokan, Tokyo, were recorded for our first album together, which was released in May under the title Just One Night. But I missed Carl, and I was riddled with guilt because he had saved my neck at one point by sending me that tape, and I'd turned my back on him. I never saw him again. In May 1980, the news reached me that he had died of kidney failure, brought on by the effects of alcohol and narcotics. And deep down, I felt partly responsible for it. When I heard about Carl, we had just completed a UK tour, our first for 18 months, so I was at home for a prolonged period. I became depressed and lost myself in drinking. My normal day became just sitting in front of the TV and responding, very aggressively, to anybody who came to the door or wanted me to do any work. I became very negative about everything. I just wanted to stay at home and get drunk, with Patty as a slave-cum-partner. I was drinking copious amounts of special brew, which I was secretly topping up with vodka so that it looked like I was only drinking beer. Then I would take coke on top of this, which was the only time when Patty would join me, as she liked to do cocaine without the booze. So this became our meeting place. At some point in the day we would go off to the pub together, either to the Windmill where we'd hang out with a landlord, or to the Ship to meet the Ripleyites. Nor did Patty's presence get in the way of me trying to get something going with one of the barmaids, or indeed any woman who walked in the door. Then I would round people up and invite them back home, often complete strangers. My favourite thing was to pick up derelicts, or men of the road, as I preferred to call them, my thinking being that these were real people. I'd see one walking along the road and stop the car and pick him up. They were often barking mad and talking gibberish, but I'd take them home and Patty would have to cook dinner for them. It wasn't long before she was having to tell people not to offer me drinks if we were out, because she could see I was getting worse. I couldn't get Carl out of my mind. The band did a short tour of Scandinavia in September and October, during which the coroner's report into his death was published. The next day I wrote the following entry in my diary. I have written, unwittingly, a song for Carl Dean, and as a result I am drinking too much and wallowing in the glory of being the one who had the strings of altering his destiny, so they say. Doesn't it occur to anyone that I was in the front line with him? I haven't even read the report, so why should I be so hurt and angry? I will tell you why. I loved and left the man, and there will never be a day go by when he doesn't enter my heart. If I am guilty, then God alone will cut me down, and all will be forgiven, even those who calm me and tell me it's all a bad dream. We cut the song beautifully, and it shall be called ECCD. By the time we set off, at the beginning of 1981, on a major 57-date tour of the USA, my booze intake was being supplemented by large quantities of Vegenin, a codeine-based sedative. I was suffering from a bad back, caused, I thought, by a hefty slap from my Irish pal Joe Kilduff, whom I'd been drinking with a couple of months previously on one of my visits to Barberstown Castle. At first I was taking about 9 at a go, several times a day, but then as the pain got worse and I couldn't sleep, I began to take more and more, till I was swallowing up to 50 tablets a day. The upshot was that on Friday, March the 13th, 7 dates into the tour, I collapsed in agony as I came off stage in Madison, Wisconsin. We flew to St. Paul, Minnesota, where Roger had me rushed to a hospital. I was diagnosed with 5 bleeding ulcers. One was the size of a small orange. The doctors told Roger, who wanted to fly me back to England, that I could die at any moment, since one of the ulcers was pressing on my pancreas and could burst immediately. I was immediately admitted into United Hospital, and the following morning Roger spent his time cancelling the remains of the tour, which numbered 50 shows. It was a big enough insurance disaster for the bell to be rung at Lloyd's. They kept me in the hospital for about 6 weeks, treating me with a drug called Tagamet. I remember one of the first questions they asked me was, "How much are you drinking? Because we think that might be your problem." To which I replied, "Don't be ridiculous. I'm English. We all drink there, you know. It's part of our lifestyle, and we drink strong ale, not Budweiser." So they said, "Well, would you ever consider trying to cut back?" And I replied, "Of course." The funny thing is that I don't recall missing alcohol at all while I was in the hospital, perhaps because I was on so much medication. They also allowed me to smoke out in the corridor or outside. I actually enjoyed feeling well again and being in good health. When I was finally released from the hospital, I felt like I had a new lease on life because my physical condition was restored. My sanity, however, hadn't been addressed at all. The doctors who treated me had cured my ulcers with drugs and repaired my overall well-being, but my mental state was still the same. I was totally ignorant about the whole subject of alcoholism. I was quite happy to admit to being an alcoholic, but only in a jokey way. I wasn't prepared to admit that it was a real problem. I was still at that stage where I would say, "I don't have a problem. I never spill a drop." They did address my situation mildly by telling me that it would be good for me to give up drinking altogether after I left the hospital. So I made deals with them along the lines of, "Well, if I moderate and cut it down to 2 or 3 scotches a day, would that be all right?" And they would say, "Fine," without realizing that they were dealing with a chronic alcoholic to whom 2 or 3 scotches was just breakfast. When I did eventually get home for the satisfaction of Patty, I made a half-hearted attempt to moderate, but it was really no more than me saying, "Let's have a glass of wine at lunch today, instead of special brew." After a couple of months, I was back to 2 bottles a day, and didn't give a damn about my health. One person who inadvertently shocked some sense into me regarding my drinking was Sid Perrin, whose health had rapidly deteriorated over the past year, much to the distress of my mother. He first of all had to have a colostomy, which hit him hard. His dignity and self-respect were destroyed by having to wear the bag. Then he developed liver and kidney problems, all drink-related, and really lost his will to live. On the last occasion I saw him, visiting him in the hospital with Pat, he was hallucinating and talking to people who weren't in the room. I had never seen anything like this before. Sid died early in November, and to a certain extent, for me, Ripley died with him. It was the end of the good times. Uncle Adrian and I got incredibly drunk at his funeral and behaved in the most awful way in front of everybody, our excuse being that it was the way Sid would have liked us to behave. It was unforgivable, and my mother was livid with fury. I was very upset by Sid's passing, and in a way it showed me where I was heading. I thought to myself, it won't be long before this kind of thing is going to happen to me. But instead of slowing my drinking down, it spurred me on to drink even more, in a desperate attempt to try and blot it out. The fallacy about drinking, however, is that when people say they drink to forget, all it does is magnify the problem. I would have a drink to banish the problem, and then, when it didn't go away, have another one. So the end of my drinking days were really insane, because I was constantly spurred on by the hope that I could somehow get to another place. I was hiding booze everywhere, smuggling it in and out, and concealing it in places I thought no one would look. I'd usually, for example, have half a bottle of vodka underneath the mat where the pedals are in the car. My rock bottom was preceded by a number of warnings, the first during a weekend away visiting some friends in the country. We had been invited to stay with Bob Pridden, sound engineer for The Who, who was married to Lady Maria Noel, one of the daughters of the Earl of Gainsborough, and they lived in a house on the grounds of Exton Park, the family home in Rutland. Being full of bravado, and therefore having no idea what I was taking on, I promised Patty that I would not drink during the trip. We set off on the journey, and when we were quite close to the destination, we got lost. I spotted a telephone box and stopped to call Bob to get the final directions. While I was talking to him, I suddenly felt faint and a bit dizzy and fell against the side of the kiosk. The blood soon came back to my head, and I straightened up and finished the conversation, but I was a little perturbed. When we arrived, we were met by Bob and Maria, who showed us our room, and then we had something to eat. I noticed there was no booze to be seen, and then it struck me, because I knew that Bob liked to take a drink, that they obviously had been told to hide or lock up all the liquor. I remember getting up in the middle of the night and prowling around the house, opening every cupboard to try and find some alcohol, without success. The next day Bob was going duck shooting, and I went with him and helped him carry his stuff, and by the time we returned I was feeling a bit agitated from not having any alcohol. I started suffering the first signs of withdrawal. That night we went out to a local restaurant, The George, at Stamford, for dinner. It was a grand occasion, with a lot of very posh county people, and I noticed that while we were sitting in the bar before dinner, everyone was drinking water or orange juice, which made me think that these people, too, had been given the EC brief. We went in to dinner, and I'd hardly sat down at the table when I felt the earth revolve. I was sitting upright, but the room went sideways, and the next thing I remember, I was coming to in the back of an ambulance. Patty was with me, literally shaking with fear, as she had no idea what had happened. It turned out that I had suffered a grand mal seizure, brought on by abruptly ceasing my heavy intake of alcohol without medical supervision. I was admitted into the Wellington Hospital in London for tests, where I was soon diagnosed as having a late-arriving form of epilepsy that they said could have been dormant in my system for years. They then gave me the appropriate medication, which was fine, because it was another chemical to play with. Soon after this, at the end of November, we flew to Japan for a short 8-day tour opening in Niigata. When we arrived at our hotel in Tokyo a few days later, I went up to my room to find I'd been given a bottle of sake that had flakes of pure gold floating in it, a very highly regarded gift in Japan. I drank it in one sitting, and within a few hours I had a serious physical reaction. My body became covered from head to foot with an enormous rash, and my skin started peeling off. Somehow I got through the show, and that night I showed Roger, and he reiterated what he had been saying for months. "You're an alcoholic." Of course I refused to accept it. That Christmas we had lots of people staying at Hurtwood, close friends and family of all ages. I had asked Santa for some special thermal underwear for fishing, and on Christmas Eve I waited till everyone was asleep, and then, blind drunk, I decided to open my gifts. There I was, in the middle of the night, sitting under the tree opening presents, the kind of thing a naughty boy of 5 would do. I found my precious, bright green thermal underwear and put it on, and went wandering. When I came to, hours later, I was lying in the cellar in my new thermals, looking like Kermit the Frog, with flashlights shining in my face. It was Christmas morning, and everyone had panicked because I had disappeared and no one knew where I was. Patty had been particularly scared because I was prone to walk out of the house in the middle of the night with no clothes on and try to get into the car and drive off. She was at her wit's end when they found me in the cellar, and I was laughing and crying at the same time. It was ghastly, and I remember seeing the fear in the eyes of the people who were looking at me. Patty was understandably furious. She took me upstairs and put me to bed. "You're staying here till everyone's gone," she told me. "We're going to enjoy Christmas without you." And she left the room, locking the door behind her. She was very clever and very wise, and she kept me in the room, feeding me just enough food and alcohol to keep me sedated. I was so confused about what had taken place, and so ashamed of the damage I had done, that I didn't put up any fight whatsoever. I knew she was right, and that I had to lie low and just do as I was ordered for a little while. If that weren't bad enough, my real rock bottom took place a few days later, after the guests had all left. Early in the morning, wearing my new thermal underwear, I crept out of the house to go fishing. I drove down to the River Wey to try out the water near one of the locks. I had some brand new equipment, 2 hardy carp rods and a couple of Garcia reels, and I set up to fish for pike. I'm a country boy, and I've always thought of myself as a reasonably good fisherman, but on the opposite bank were a couple of professional carp fishermen with a tent and everything beautifully laid out. They had probably been there a day or two, and they were watching me. I was drunk and had just about managed to get all my gear set up when I lost my balance and fell over onto one of the rods, breaking it clean off at the handle. The other fishermen witnessed this scene, and I saw them look away in embarrassment. That was it for me. The last vestige of my self-respect had been ripped away. In my mind, being a good fisherman was the one place where I still had some self-esteem. I packed everything up again, put it in the back of the car, and drove home. I picked up the phone and called Roger. When he answered, I just said to him, "You're right. I'm in trouble. I need help." And right away I remember having this incredible feeling of relief mixed with terror, because I'd finally admitted to someone what I had been denying to myself for so long.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.